Martin was born into a world that was supported by two pillars. On the one side, the pillar of the emperor, and on the other side, the pillar of the army. Both tyrannical and impersonal forces. In between emperor and army, outside the structures of the state, the church had been growing for a couple of centuries. Unlike the empire, membership of the church was voluntary. Unlike the emperor and his officials, the bishops of the church, ordinary men, were approachable, compassionate, and available. For this reason, the church threatened the structures of the state, which led periodically to intense persecutions of the Christians. And Martin was born towards the end of the great persecution under the Emperor Diocletian. He was 9 years old when the persecution came to an end. In far-off Britain, the army elected Constantine to be the new emperor. And Constantine had a dream, and in it there appeared the symbol of the Kairo, the first two letters of the Greek alphabet, the cross and the P. And with the Kairo emblazoned on his battle banners, Constantine marched on Rome. He overcame vastly superior forces, and it was attributable to the hand of the Christian God. With the end of the persecution, Martin, a 9-year-old boy, was free to follow his curiosity. And his curiosity led him to the church in his town. Against his father's wishes, Martin would attend Christian worship. And drawn by the different quality and feel among the Christians, Martin determined that he too would one day be baptized. Martin was born into a staunchly Roman upper-class family. His father was a tribune in the army. His parents must have been greatly concerned by the impressionable young Martin being drawn away from what every good Roman should be doing. And so, at the age of 15, his father kidnapped him. Martin was manacled, bundled into a military wagon, transported 25 miles away to the nearest army camp, where he was enforced to enlist for a period of 25 years. As with all of us, it's the early experiences in Martin's life that shaped the rest of his life. And so we have the first chapter, his kidnapping and his enforced enlistment into the army, that was to create within Martin an internal tension between love and duty. And it's this tension that would shape the subsequent flow of his development and of his life. Now, as the son of a tribune, Martin would have enjoyed many, many privileges over those of the enlisted men. He would have had better food, he would have had better lodging, he would have had more recreation time. And Martin put that time to good use. He continued to prepare for the day of his baptism. We have this wonderful window in our church which depicts Martin's cutting of his military cloak in half and clothing a naked beggar with one half of the cloak. He had to hold on to the other half because for the Roman soldier he only owned half his cloak, the rest, the other half belonged to the army. And so we have this wonderful story of Martin depicted at the gates of Amiens, where he was stationed in Gaul. And this is just one instance of Martin's relationship to the poor and the needy. Why should he care so much? He was an impressionable, rather inward-looking man. And for Martin, his care for those in greater need than himself was the way that he continued to prepare for his baptism, to show that he was worthy of being baptized. We can assume that one of the duties, and perhaps the key duty, that defined Martin's career as a military officer was the role of medicus. The medicus was the soldier doctor who attended to the physical care and well-being of the soldiers, which extended to the performance of surgery on the battlefield. Being a medicus would have commended Martin to his fellow officers, and perhaps they came to see his preoccupation with baptism and with being a Christian as part of that range of personal qualities that they also so admired in him. And here is the paradox of Martin's life. It was the army that molded him into the monk and hermit he was to become. Perhaps his father had been correct, like many fathers. Obviously, his father believed that the army would make a man of his son. The consequence was perhaps not what he intended or envisioned, but it's the army and that experience of 25 years that shaped and molded Martin. It's interesting to note that the Roman army had three core principles. The first was obedience. And being bound by obedience is paradoxically a very freeing experience. When you don't have to worry about making every decision in your life, it's very liberating. The second principle was poverty. The Roman soldier owned nothing. He was clothed, he was armed, he was fed. And until the day of his discharge, he possessed nothing. And the third principle of the Roman army was celibacy. During the period of enlistment, the Roman soldier was expected to be celibate, to remain unmarried. This requirement was relaxed somewhat in the 3rd century when, under the pressure of the barbarians on the borders of the empire, it required for the army to set up more permanent garrisons on the frontier and the allowance for marriage and family life would have been understood to have been a great support to the troops on the front. Familiar, obedience, poverty, chastity. They become the core of Benedict's understanding of the religious life. And we call Benedict the father of Western monasticism, but actually it's Martin who is really the father of Western monasticism. And the hermit and monk that Martin was to become was shaped by these 25 years of discipline, shaped by these three principles of army life. And so rather than the army and his military career inhibiting his development as a spiritual person, it really enhanced him and gave him the foundation that was to establish his whole way of living once he was discharged. At the age of 40, Martin was discharged. And there are lots of wonderful stories about the events that surrounded that. However, I have to save some things for another St. Martin's Day sermon. And after his discharge, Martin spent a number of years as a hermit, attracted to the great St. Hilary of Poitiers, the Bishop of Poitiers. Martin developed his own particular interpretation of being a Christian in the world. And it's during this period that Martin's reputation as a holy man is established. You have to remember that Christianity, particularly in Gaul, modern France, was really just a surface baptism of the old Druid religion. The Druid religion was a religion of the countryside, of trees and caves and rivers. Martin lived in these remote places. He lived in Ligugey, outside of Poitiers, in a system of caves. And it was there that he attracted many young men of noble birth and some women. The women were not allowed to live in the wilderness. They were enforced into a house in the town. But because of Martin's particular charism and his need for isolation in rural settings, and because of the many acts that he was able to perform, which were regarded by the local people as miraculous, Martin became a bridge figure between the Christian church and the people's ancient Druid faith. That, again, is a sermon for another day. But what I want to draw our attention to tonight is this central tension that lay at the heart of Martin's life, this tension between love and duty. As a 15-year-old lad, he was kidnapped and bound and enforced into military service. And that tension between love and duty remained in him and kept working its way out through his life as a military officer and into that period of his life as a wandering hermit monk. Until the day, in this setting of Ligugey, surrounded by, I imagine, limestone cliffs and caves and a grassy field, which had been settled by those who had been drawn to Martin to share this kind of hermetical life. The people of Tours arrived, having walked 100 miles from Tours to Poitiers. And they engaged Martin in conversation. And they kidnapped him. We have this wonderful story here in the parish, don't we, about Martin hiding amongst a flock of geese. Well, we're not quite sure whether that really happened or not, but we do know that Martin was kidnapped by the people of Tours. His hands were bound, and he was placed on the back of a donkey. And against his will, he was carted off to his election as a bishop. These two experiences bracket Martin for us and show how this tension between love and duty erupted into external events. The election of Martin to be the Bishop of Tours was a very colourful process. At this point, the old customs of the Christian Church, whereby the people raised up someone to be their bishop, and the bishop was then consecrated by the other bishops of the locality, was giving away to a more structured and organized and state-sponsored process, whereby the emperor wanted to appoint the bishops, and he appointed a senior bishop to oversee the process of local elections. The people loudly proclaimed Martin. They wanted him. The bishops of the region had a different view. They referred to Martin as crinum deformen, which means ugly-haired. As these Christian bishops, now increasingly enjoying the privileges of the Roman state, drawing the emperor's stipend, as they saw Martin, this disheveled, dirty, emaciated hermit monk standing before them, you can imagine them saying, "No way, Jose, is he going to be the next Bishop of Tours?" And of course, you can imagine the tumult and the riotousness and the noise as the people refused to accept this decision. They wanted Martin. They wanted a man who would symbolize for them their connection to the old religion. They wanted a man who was humble. They wanted a man of prayer. They wanted a man who would care for them. They didn't want some imperial policeman. In an attempt to get the process rolling, the presiding bishop called for the liturgy to begin with the reading of the lessons. And there was a problem. The lector could not get into the church. The people barred his entry. And there was an embarrassed silence, during which one of the deacons arose and opened his psalmody. And he read out the following passage. Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, the Lord has sent his angel and avenger. Now, it just so happened that the Latin word for avenger was the same word that was used for the title of the presiding bishop. And the people loudly proclaimed that this was an oracle from God. And faced with this enormous pressure, the bishops of the region obviously gave way and Martin was consecrated as the Bishop of Tours. We think this was a set-up job because something very similar happened 3 years later in Milan when Ambrose, the governor of Liguria, attended the election of the new bishop and a child called out, "Ambrose for bishop!" And within 7 days, Ambrose, who was not even baptized at that point, found himself baptized, consecrated, and bishop. Martin, a man for our times. The reason that Anglican Christians follow the ancient practice of naming churches after saints is because there is an assumption that the qualities of the saint will mold and shape the character of the community. And here at St. Martin's in Providence, Martin's character has certainly shaped us in our concern for the world around us, our concern for the poor, our concern for those who are less privileged and less well off than we are. And yet so often that impulse, that instinct to reach out and to care for others, where does that come from in us? Does it come from a place where we are mindful of our duty to be good people and to do what good people do? Or does it come from somewhere deeper in us, a deep sense of love for God, which spills out in our relationships with one another and the world around us? Martin and his life of charity was not marked by busy do-gooding. It was marked for his contemporaries by an often perplexing, lost in contemplative revelry. Martin was administratively not a very good bishop. He spent too much time on his knees in prayer. But it's from that deep well that Martin's concern for others flowed. And so, Martin, a man for our times. And as we face the coming challenges of the years ahead, we could have no better patron than Martin of Tours. A man, paradoxically, for our own time. Amen.